on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Long this earth has watched the many, over time their journeys laid, multitudes of actors playing stories of the times they strayed, far from home, that place of knowing, to a different garden, where they'd be sowing seeds that offer them a chance to engage in a wondrous earthly dance. Now some sojourners kept their sense of kinship with the mystery, seeing past the passion play and accessing an earthly key that took them deep beneath the surface story of the day, into deep, into direct connection with the keepers of the beauty way.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by poet, author, teacher, and guide, Shona Holm, to discuss her book, Poetic Whispers from the Cauldron of the Otherworld. In addition to sharing some of her poetry, Shona talks about her training with mushrooms, psilocybin as a portal in the Elders of Gaia, the She, how she began to receive her poetic transmissions, and the cauldron and inspiration. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Shona Holm is a teacher, guide, author, and poet. Of Celtic heritage, she follows the wisdom of the ancients and is inspired by the Bán Dri and Fila, Gaelic for a Celtic medicine woman, seer, poet. As a modern medicine woman, she brings her connection to nature and the spirit worlds into her flourishing practice, hosting retreats and online counseling sessions, where she works psycho-spiritually with clients from all over the world. She specializes in shadow work, delving into the rich territory of the psyche. Shona has studied with master teachers, and for the past 12 years has apprenticed herself to the mushroom teachers who have led her into profound connection with the spirits of nature and her ancestral roots. She is the author of Ishell Wisdom, Love and Spirit Medicine, and Poetic Whispers from the Cauldron of the Otherworld. In addition, she hosts the podcast The Mushroom's Apprentice. Shona, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you, Nick. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, so am I. I read this is your latest book, The Poetic Whispers of the Cauldron of the Otherworld. And I liked how you had sort of essays followed by poetry. I thought that was really effective. And I believe that you're going to be reading some of the poems for us this morning. But I thought before we get into that, I would ask you about your journey with the mushrooms. Kind of what led you to them? And how has your relationship with them unfolded?
Okay, well, I'll start by saying that I have just lived this very sort of what I call healthy life, right? So I had my foray into the Dionysian temple of, you know, drugs, alcohol, and all that stuff when I was a teenager. And then that ended at the age of 21. I was like, all right, we're done. We are moving forward here. And glad to survive that. And it wasn't until, I hit 40, my marriage fell apart. And then that was what I call the midlife face slap and launched me into very deep spiritual soul study, if you will. And I met a wonderful man who was a student of a teacher named Dr. Brewjoy, who is a Johns Hopkins trained MD. And he walked away from a very illustrious career to teach. And he was Jungian inspired, but had his own just incredible philosophy and magic. And so he was really my teacher for this lifetime. And so I worked with him I had 3 years with him. And then I worked with a number of other teachers, like a small handful of really wonderful, good people. And at the age of 48, that was when I was hearing about this plant medicine. I was hearing a lot about ayahuasca, and I actually tried ayahuasca, worked with it a couple of times, but it came to me, this is not my medicine. And a few months after that, I could feel a call from the mushroom. And I had a dear friend who worked with that up in the Washington rainforest. And so I asked him if he would induct me, and trusted him implicitly. And so I drove up to where he was. I had my first mushroom experience, and it was outside in the Washington rainforest at night with the sound of a waterfall nearby, and absolutely exquisite and mind-blowing. And when I got out of that, I said, "This is a portal. This is absolutely a portal." And before that, again, like no alcohol, no drugs, no pharmaceutical, like nothing. But I didn't see this as a drug. I still don't. I see it as it's a sacrament, it's a medicine, it's a portal. And that's what I said after my first experience was, "My God, this is a portal. This is,
Yeah.
my goodness, a mystery, a great mystery." And so I went home and I was very opened and activated by that. And the following month, I asked if I could come back up there and work with it again. And he said yes. And so I ended up having 12 months in a row of these monthly deep forays. And we had been following the wisdom of Terence McKenna, who would say 5 dry grams lying
Right.
down in silent darkness, which is interesting because we'll talk later about the seer poets of old Ireland, and their training was through incubation, which was in silent darkness. So in any case, I did that for 12 months, and it wasn't planned, but that's just how it happened. And I just had an extraordinary year. I also experienced a dark night of the soul. Like, it was so initiatory, which was designed to be. And looking back, I see that was a kind of soul training. And also, very early on, maybe after a couple of months, I realized, you know what? These are teachers. And I am going to apprentice myself to these teachers. And prior to that, I'd had a good 8 years of really intense work with these excellent teachers. So I was prepared, thank goodness. And especially my work with Brew, because he was very skilled in working with shadow and dreams. And all of that was very preparatory. And so I would go in, and I would go in every time, I still do, humble, open heart, seeking wisdom. I wanted to sit at the feet of the sages. And I heard poet Sean Padraig O'Donohue posted something on his Substack, and he was quoting the herbalist Stephen Harrod Buhner, who I think passed away a year or so ago. But Stephen Buhner referred to the psilocybin mushroom as elders of Gaia. And I just love that. And so, yeah, I was like, yeah, that is perfect, elders of Gaia. So that is who I apprenticed myself to. And at, so the first 2, maybe 3 years, there was a lot of emphasis on, well, they would say constantly, "Get your mind right, dear. Get your mind right." Because I suffered over the course of my life from chronic worry and at times crippling self-doubt, and I would never medicate because I don't do pharmaceuticals. And so in my mind it was like, I gotta figure this out, which I did. And so the mushroom helped me dramatically. But they were saying, it's a mess in here, you know, you've got a lot to kind of work through. And so I'd go in these deep journeys, and you'd have these extraordinary insights. And then I'd come out, and if I had to make right on something, I would make right. If I had to work on something, I would, you know, that's how it went for me. And after those first couple of years, poetry started coming, rhyme. And it would come not just on a mushroom journey, but if I was out on my morning runs. And because you're in this kind of mild, subtle trance state. And so it's like a door inside opens and in it flows, and then the door shuts. And it's really quite something because actually, as a poet, I'm pretty unimpressive. Like, when I try to, I'm like, oh my God, this is stupid. And then when this flows through, my goodness, I mean, it's just, there's no what rhymes with, wait, what's a good, it's not like that. It comes through like you're taking dictation. And Brew, my teacher, spoke of our unconscious or deep psyche. It's really a mystery. I think Jung was the one who came closest to really exploring what that is about. But Brew was saying how we have it, it's we've got the outer consciousness, our personality that we're in right now. The unconscious transcends the personality and it connects to the collective unconscious. So everything is in there. So when you're in these high trance states, you have access to all of that, or mild trance state, whatever it is, but there's this inner door and things come through. Whether you are a painter, or a musician, I mean, the artist, Terence McKenna said the artists really are the shamans. They are the shamans are channeling the muse. So.
So there's a lot that I kind of want to talk about just based on what you just said, different concepts. The one thing I do want to say right up front is I'm very glad that you make a distinction between medicine and drug, because in my experience, often, drugs are demonized and traditional cultures have been using these medicines for sometimes thousands of years. And because people have that association with drug, they automatically will, and I find it somewhat a little racist of, these are drugs, these are bad. And I'm like, well, if you're saying that, what are you saying about these indigenous people? So that's why I think it's so important to make that distinction between medicine and drug. But also the fact that you're referring to them as teachers, and that's been my experience. And I've done a few sessions with ayahuasca as well, but I have never found it to be the same with the mushrooms. And part of my personal experience was I had gone a long time without working with the mushrooms. And I remember it came to me, I'm like, I think it's time to start working with them again. And so what I did is I just stated out loud, I'm like, spirit of the mushroom, if this is right, if the time is right, then I would like to start this work again. And like 2 days later, I get a message from the last person I would ever expect to get it from saying, hey, a friend of mine has all these. Would you like to get some? I'm like, there you go. And dreams, I have dreams of of them. So there's something to them that is, it is otherworldly, but also very thisworldly. It opens up gates, it opens up doors.
Yes, perfect. I love that. Yeah, it's a gateway.
So I just wanted to share that we have that little bit of a shared experience there. The messages come through and they are teachers, and there's, I don't know how to describe it for anyone who has not worked with them, but there's something very powerful and potent. Very powerful and potent. I also like the idea. This is another point where I thought we could talk about a little bit, which was the use of these with poetry. And because there is actually a tradition of poets altering their consciousness in order to do the work.
Yes, there is. Probably for people who are familiar with psychedelics, just about everyone knows who Maria Sabina was. And so she would speak poetically, and there's recordings of her poetry when she was in that mantic state. And also, there's a fantastic book called The Woman in the Shaman's Body by Barbara Tedlock, PhD, and she wrote that I think in 2002. It's a fantastic book. And Barbara speaks to this couple in Mexico. They were ayahuasca, and what they would work with their patients, they would take the mushroom, and they would also, they've had different ways of working, and his was decidedly more masculine, and the way he would sort of work with kind of the evil spirits or whatever, meaning the sicknesses, right? So, and the way Maria Figueroa would work, which was decidedly more kind of a feminine way of doing so, but they would speak poetically. And so that goes way, way back. And even though we have no records in the Celtic world or Scandinavia, Norway, Eastern Europe, of the sort of shaman folk taking anything like that. Mushrooms, as well as the Amanita muscaria, which is a very different experience. I've not worked with that, but they grow all over the British Isles. And the Druids, who were highly, highly educated for 20 years in a number of subjects, including, of course, botany and medicine, healing, all of that. There's no way that that would have escaped their notice. There's absolutely, it's not like we just discovered this, right? But these, oh, and also the oracles of Delphi, they also spoke in hexameter poetry. And so they would go into these high trance states and speak poetically. So it's very, very old. And I realized that when I discovered that when I started kind of researching for my book. I was like, my God. And I think it's, for me, it's just been really fun to kind of be so green and not have any information, right? And then discover as you go along, my goodness. I mean, nature was just initiating me, and this was just an organic process.
And it takes us to this idea as well that there's a spirit to nature, that we tend to think of nature as being kind of deadish, but it's not. There's a soul to it.
Yes. This is a very, this culture we're in, it's become so commercialized. And then you have your kind of state-approved religions, which carry a lot of dogma, theological stuff. But then you have, I mean, really, we are nature. And because of it's the commercial nature of this culture, and it doesn't matter if it's, I don't care if it's socialism, capitalism, communism, oh my God, that's like the antithesis of nature. I mean, they all sort of have their like, but it's removes people from their natural state. And it's relatively new because every culture around the world was very animist. And also honored their ancestors. And you'd think, why would they leave something out for the ancestors? Like they're dead. Why are you leaving milk or whatever? It's like they understood, no, nothing really dies. It changes form. So, there was this deeper understanding of what it is to be human and spirit. And the two are connected. Obviously, we're spirit having this human experience. And everything we see in nature is, it's sort of, we're seeing the temporal expression of something that's very timeless, whatever is inspiriting that. And so that was understood. And there's different qualities depending on where you are. And certainly among in the fairy faith, if you will, there would be certain groups of fairy, shall we say, that you would avoid. You just like, no, you don't want to go over there, And that's, I think, also an understanding of these sort of qualities. There's certain areas where it's just, you just avoid, and you know it instinctively. And then other areas where you feel just naturally very welcome and comfortable. So the land itself has personality, very much so.
Well, and there was something that you wrote in the book, and I do want to talk about the fae and the she here, but before we get there, because one of the things that I was thinking as you were speaking is it seems, we're in what is being referred to as a psychedelic renaissance. And, I'm in Colorado now, and psilocybin mushrooms have been completely decriminalized. And there are various other places that they've been decriminalized. And it seems to me that that this isn't by accident. It almost seems like Gaia is saying, hey, you know what? We need to restore this connection. And I know exactly the medicine that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always thought that.
But you also had a little bit of a warning, and this is something that I have thought about quite a bit. I'm going to read, this is from your book. With psychedelics so popular today and corporations scrambling to get in the game and monopolize the action, as it were, these mystical states of beauty, inspiration, and poetry are at risk of being cast aside in favor of a state-approved conventional model that is more concerned with getting people back to work than bringing them in touch with the numinous. And I thought that was an incredibly important observation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Because I know that there are, I probably always misstate the terminology, but hedge fund managers and investors and everything. And they're having conferences about psychedelic medicines in Las Vegas. And it's like, I don't see that as a good path.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I think, yeah, there's a lot of money invested and there's people aiming to make hundreds of millions of dollars. This is
Yeah.
big, big, big business. And there was these retreat centers and whatnot. And I remember talking to a friend of mine in Australia he's in his 70s, I think, and he's been working with mushrooms since the 60s, and he's a fantastic artist, visionary artist. But he said to me, look, he said, they're going to profane it. It's just where we're at.
Yeah.
Everything gets profaned,
Yeah.
everything. He
Yeah.
said, all we can do is maintain kind of our individual foothold and, do what we are doing with
Yeah.
integrity and care. And I do think, of course, there will be people who will be helped by going to those places. And there will be other people who will maybe prefer to, seek out maybe a more traditional or intimate
Yeah.
experience.
Yeah.
I'm all about the one-on-one. I love the one-on-one, and I'm not really a group person. It's
Right.
funny because I'm like, I love people, but I can be at times almost like socially awkward,
Yeah.
And whereas I love the one-on-one
Yeah.
so that's how I like to work.
Okay. Well, since we're here, can you say something about the retreats, these individualized retreats that you're offering to
Well,
people?
I'm in my 9th year of doing these, and I wasn't looking to do this at all. It wouldn't even occur to me. I was working online, just counseling with different people, and one of my clients said, "Is there?" asked if there was any way she could come work with me. She said, "Could I come maybe stay with you? I've been working, I knew her." And she said, "For maybe a few days and just soak up your knowledge and maybe do the medicine." And I was like, I think about that because I have to figure out like how that would even work. And so I ended up going to my friend's place in the Washington rainforest. He said, "You can use my house." So this person flew out and stayed for 3 days, and I did the medicine with her, which anyway, I had no idea it was going to burgeon like it did, but it was amazing. And then the following week, I had a client who would come in person. And so I just mentioned to her, kind of like, guess what I did this weekend, And her whole face changed. And she was like, "You do that? You didn't tell me that." And she opens her purse and she takes out her checkbook. And she said, "What do you charge for these? I want to do one." And I was like, "Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I don't know what I charge." And so we went back up to the rainforest and worked together. And then when we got back, a friend of mine said, "Hey, I've got my buddy and his wife want to know if they can fly out from New Jersey and work with you." And I was like, "Wait, what's going on?" And then I realized this is continuing, and it's not legal where I am, of course, but I can talk about the past in any
Right.
case, because I've slowed down. I was working, I had a couple of years where I worked like 47 weeks out of the year, because they would arrive on a Sunday and we would do this deep work Monday through Thursday, and then they'd leave Friday morning. And then, of course, there's follow-up. I would continue to work with some people, but it's, oh my goodness, just my heart's work. And very traditional in that, the shaman back in the day didn't have a clinic, they didn't have a retreat center, they had a household,
Right.
so people would have to seek them out, and then you'd whatever stay there and
Right.
learn or get healed or whatever it was. And so I'm teaching. I know a lot about traditional foods, and so many people are dealing with a lot of physical issues. So there's all of that. There's the, shall we say, the opportunity to go quite deep. And then a lot of what I call delving, and I'm also quite psychic, so I can tap into the unconscious. And then I will also use cards and the I Ching as a kind of bridge. And so it's a really unique experience. It's all about them, and there's no one around to have to feel like, oh, I'm not going to say that. There's
Right.
no one around to kind of get in the way. So there aren't too many opportunities where you can go away for, a few days and have it be totally the attention focused on you and your inner workings and, your inner possibilities. potential. So it's been very special work, very
Yeah.
special.
Yeah. Now, do you have like a background in counseling or anything like that?
I never went to school for
Okay.
this, so I'm very much an autodidact.
Okay.
And I had those 8 years working with teachers, and Brew
Right.
was really the first. He was my teacher for this lifetime, but he was my introduction to Jung and shadow. And he had a big following of a lot of students who were themselves psychotherapists and MDs, that kind of thing, I think, because of his background as a medical doctor. I remember asking one of the therapists, I said, "What's projection? I don't get it." You know, like I was so green. But then I love to read, and I fell in love with Edward Edinger, who was a student of Jung, and Marie-Louise von Franz, and then again, the way I look at this too is, I mean, it takes age, also maturity, and you're either good at working with people, you
Right.
know, and listening and offering, you know, your insights, or you're not.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so yeah, I mean, I'm pretty good at it, and I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I love
Yeah.
helping people.
Yeah. Now, what about the shamanic aspect? Did you have any kind of training with that, or was it that the
Yes.
mushrooms taught
Yeah,
you?
I had training in the shamanic piece. Yes. And so I worked with a beautiful shaman teacher in the Yucatan, Miguel Angel Vergara. And
Okay.
so he was amazing. And then I worked with a wonderful man, John Knowlton. And I did a 2-year training where he came to the house of my husband at the time and myself. And there were 10 of us. And so these other people would converge. A couple of them would stay with us because they were traveling from a distance. I would make all the food. And he came for 4 weekends out of the year for 2 years. And that we were going into the Peruvian piece. So Peruvian shamanism and, you know, with the mesa and all of this. And it was interesting. I mean, it was amazing. He was a fantastic teacher, absolutely fantastic. And he said something I never forgot. He said, "When you do this work," and he wasn't speaking to psychedelics, he was just speaking in general. You know, when you're working with someone one-on-one, you must be impeccable. Now, also, he said, and we're human and we make mistakes. And when you make a mistake, you know, own it and learn from it.
Right.
And then, you know, keep going. So he was just beautiful. So yes, that was my training, and then a lot on my own as well. And then when the mushrooms came, all of that was so preparatory,
Yeah.
because also there was no shaman to guide my friend and I. You know, I sort of joked, it seems like there's one on every street corner nowadays. It's like all the rage, right? But back then, that was almost 13 years ago. And so we were on our own, but we had both had really superb training.
Right.
You know, I worked with just a small handful of teachers, and they were really good people, really, really tremendous integrity. And so we just knew, and we did ritual beforehand. You know, we're prepared, and you know, went in, and then I would write about every experience, and that actually became, that first year of Mushroom Journeys became my book, Love and Spirit Medicine, which chronicled that, because I love to read. I was reading everything I could find on the mushrooms because I'm a natural researcher. But I was like, where are the women?
Yeah.
And I don't consider myself a feminist, because I don't kind of like the direction that's gone, but I'm just more like, hey, we're people, you know, so we all, you know, should be able to have an opportunity to do, you know, what we dream of. But in any case, I was just like, I would like to see some women's voices here. What's going on? It's mostly men, and these guys are wonderful and, you know, great read. I found Margaret Deweese, who wrote Black Smoke, which was about her experience with ayahuasca and with an ayahuasca shaman, and she had breast cancer. And that was a fantastic book. So I just started writing about my experiences, and then my marriage was falling apart anyway. So it turned into a book. And so that's kind of what I put myself out there, ended up putting myself out there kind of publicly as an older woman's voice for the reverent use
Right.
of the medicine. But also, I talk a lot about the spirits. And I think, you know, when you have a PhD and, you know, you're at a university and whatever, those people, you know, they can't freely discuss that.
Right.
And I'm sure a number of them wouldn't feel comfortable anyway, but that's a big component. This is ancient.
Yeah.
This is ancient. It's not really, the universities don't have the corner on this,
Right.
unless, of course, I mean, this is deeply shamanic. It's
Yeah.
earth.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right about academia. And, that's, I've spent the past 30 years in academia, and I have gone through this sort of transformation very recently, having doing this podcast, but also personal experiences where, I have challenged, I don't accept this sort of materialist worldview that is dominant in our entire world. And I have found myself more, it's all consciousness and kind of going into an animist perspective. And if you adopt an animist perspective, you have to be open to the fact that there are other consciousnesses, there are other spirits. And we have this history of people making, having contact with them. And there's got to be something going on. So it's been a journey. And, and I say that because it's been a running joke with a friend of one of my best friends who I did grad school with, that I, when I was starting the podcast, I'm like, oh yeah, but if they say they're talking to the fairies, that's it. No, I'm not doing that.
Famous last words.
And so now I'm like, well, I, why give privilege to this experience versus this one? And so I've opened up to that and said, look, it's all part of this experience, and maybe there's something there. And, it was a opening up of the mind, of possibilities. So I do want to talk about the fae and the she here, but I thought that maybe we can, I can ask you to read one of your poems. Do you think this is a good place to read one of your
Sure.
poems?
Yes, this one, let me find this. This is called, it's in the book, it's called Keepers of the Beauty Way. Now, this came in on one of my morning runs. And so this was probably the second year of working with these mushrooms. And I mean, I was quite activated. And I would go on these runs, and also my first 6 months of mushroom journeys took place outside in the Washington rainforest. And we would always be in this grove of cedars. And then next to me on my right was a huckleberry bush. And so when you're opened on the mushroom, of course, you can see the energy field around everything. And this bush was just, I don't know, I had a connection with that bush. So every so often on my run, I would see huckleberry bushes and similar vegetation. So anyway, these beautiful pieces would come in. The first time it happened, I was like, oh my goodness, I got to remember this. And then I got home and the rest of it just poured through. And after that, I would bring a digital recorder. So, all right. So, by the way, this is also on my website, shonahome.com. I have some of my poetic transmissions. I put them to music and video. And this is one of them. And I love the way that video came out. Long this earth has watched the many, over time their journeys laid, multitudes of actors playing stories of the times they strayed, far from home, that place of knowing, to a different garden where they'd be sowing seeds that offer them a chance to engage in a wondrous earthly dance. Now, some sojourners kept their sense of kinship with the mystery, seeing past the passion play and accessing an earthly key that took them deep beneath the surface story of the day, into deep, into direct connection with the keepers of the beauty way. This key grows wild and close to the ground. It calls to the seer without a sound. It beckons with silent extended hand and bonds the seer to a luminous band of shimmering light-filled beings who hold the ancient secrets and magic of old. This key confers wisdom to those who come, with humble heart, retreating from the madness of crowds and the cult of delusion. The seer is seeking an ancient solution that takes her into the realms of truth and bequeaths her with the ripened fruit of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. She receives it all without commanding, then gratefully thanks the beings of light and makes her way home in the dark of night. And by day, she acts in service to all Earth's beings whose suffering begs her call. She administers herbs with expert care. She burns magical plants that clear the air. Then she speaks with wisdom and clarity, conferring light so they can see and experience epiphany. And for those with curiosity, who desire to learn the mystery, whose hearts are pure and ready for knowledge, she'll guide them to that secret college, found near the trees, those sages of old. This college springs forth from the ground in a bold explosion of unbridled reverie, playing and te playful and teasing with unabashed glee, to greet yet another seeker who yearns to taste of the deeper knowing that burns in their heart, where the memory of where they came from calls them to nature to apprentice with some of the greatest teachers the earth has known, whose wisdom and kindness has expertly sewn threads that connect the mind with the heart, threads that ensure Earth's people will start to live once again with extended hand, held fast to nature and that shimmering band of magical beings whose colleges grow up from the fertile ground below.
Wonderful, quite beautiful. And I love the passion in the recitation.
Oh, thank
Quite,
you.
yeah, quite remarkable. So, why don't we take the leap and talk about the fae and the she?
The she.
Yeah, the she. Who are the she?
That's a very good question. So, she actually in Gaelic means mound or hill. And it is thought that the she were a race of people who lived in Ireland. They were the Tuatha De Danann. And so they were the tribe of Danu. And they were very highly skilled in magic, and they arrived there and they fought the Formorians, or the Fearbook, I think it was the Formorians. In any case, so they effectively purged them and took over the land. And at some point, the Milesians showed up, the sons of Mil, and those were the Gaels. And there was and they were led by Amurgan, who was their seer poet. And so they were able to land through the mist, and a battle ensued at some point. And the Tuatha De Danann lost the battle. And so it was agreed that they would go below ground. And so, and also to the Celts, the other world was often beneath the water. So there was the god Mananaan, who was sort of king, lord of all of the water, and he actually helped the Tuatha De Danann. But they went below the water, they went also in the mounds, and they were said to be in these shimmering palaces. And so, look, this is similar. Every culture had their genius loci, their local spirits, and there were, all sorts of stories about them and offerings made to them. And so, too, the Gaelic people was no different. And so now it was also thought that they were ancestors, or when, people would pass over, they would spend time with the she as well. So, and really there are numerous races of these fairy beings. And this has gone on since Neolithic times and probably beyond that even. And there's a wonderful book called The Fairy Faith in Celtic Country, Evans Wentz. And it in around the early 1900s, 1905, something like that, he went all around the Irish countryside interviewing these people and getting these stories from them about encounters with these beings. And there were all kinds of things that were said, oh, they would take your baby and replace it with, a changeling, and so there were different superstitions around that as well. And if a very gusty wind came, that was the she, it could take you with it, so there were all kinds of stories like that. But there are a number of interesting happenings, and I wrote about a couple of them in my book. And one that I think is of particular interest was of the fellow, and this was in the 1600s, and he was accused of witchcraft. And the story was that he explained, and he was very humble, an honest man, saying that he had, his family had no money, and he was quite dejected. And he was walking one day, and this ran into this elderly woman, and she asked him, what his troubles were, and he told her, and she said, "Meet me here tomorrow at this time," and she disappeared. And so he did, and she took him to a mound, a hill, and I think she knocked three times, and anyway, a door opened, and they went into this hill. And she brought him to this queenly woman. And so this is another thing with the fairy or the elfin, similar races, they have nobility, kings and queens. And so she gave him a white powder to heal. And what I think that is interesting about that is there's something in alchemy too. There's a white powder that is used alchemically. But in any case, she gave him that, and it, he was healing people. He used it to help people. And he did say, "I'll only do this if it helps. Like, I won't participate in anything, untoward." And so he gained quite a reputation for himself, and his family was doing well. And of course, at some point, he was accused of witchcraft. And so he was taken to court, and the judge wanted this guy, tarred and feathered. But he was so humble. It was so clear that this was not, an evil man, not that any of those people were who were burned and tortured. So he even offered to take them to the place where the mound where he was given the powder. And anyway, the judge wanted him convicted. The jury would not convict him. And so it was written about in this book 20 or so years later by a fellow who had witnessed the trial. And that book actually helped to remove the whole law for burning witches, took it right out of the law books. So,
Fascinating.
interesting story,
Yeah.
because they, for these sort of scary stories, it's superstitious, they take your kids, they'll do this, they'll do that. But they're also could give you the gift of being able to heal. They would teach you magical knowledge, that kind of thing. So ultimately, I see this as, look, this culture we're in, this has been going on for a long time. I was talking about, it's a commercial culture, it's a secular culture now, and we've lost our traditions, we've lost touch with our cultural mythology. And the fact of the matter is, we are a living mystery, and this earth is a living mystery, and there is far more here than meets the eye. And I don't believe in these beings. I know them. And I also, as someone very psychic and a medium, I felt my father when he passed. He came to me. He's come to me two other times since then. I've had other people who've crossed over come. There is no
Yeah.
actual death. You just leave this body and keep going. And so this is something worthy of, revisiting. Like, what are we really a part of? And I so love the work of Rudolf Steiner, and I quoted from Steiner and a couple of other anthroposophists at the very beginning of the book, because I've also worked with his biodynamics, and you're working in the garden with the spirits of the land. And let me tell you, it works in uncanny ways. So these beings, that the mushroom's a portal. And meeting a portal, you can meet a lot of different spirits in that way. But I think the she are directly connected, or the fairy, whatever words you use. And I think it's interesting that all those Victorian images always show these mushrooms, especially the Amanita, with these elves and fairies and whatnot. But I think there's something to that. There's a great book called Ploughing the Clouds: The Search for Irish Soma by Peter Lamborn Wilson. And oh, you might really like that book, Nick. So he writes about Soma and the stories of Arjuna and that whole series of adventures and the myths of Ireland and how they are so similar, essentially saying, I think they're talking about the same thing, but they didn't write the way we do today. Like it was veiled, it was poetic, it was metaphor. And so if you were initiated, you would know what the deeper layers were really saying, essentially. So yeah.
I learned a long, long time ago, and I don't know if this is correct, but just kind of the idea of the Soma and Ireland, the idea traditionally, because Soma was connected to the Indian tradition, the Vedic tradition, and the idea was always that you had the Aryans coming down from the Russian steppe lands. And the old picture was that they were an invading force, and that's been rejected, that they were probably just kind of like migrating. But as they get into Persia, they start splintering off. And so in the Persian traditions, you have the Zoroastrian tradition, you have Halma, and then they get to India, and the languages, the names of things. So, like, Iran is derived from the root of Aryan. And what I had learned was, well, so was Ireland that had that root. Now, I don't know if that's true, but that's what I had been told early on. And so, yes, I do want to read that book now because that seems to make that kind of connection. And I love how it's all connected. It's
It
all
really is.
connected.
Yeah.
So now you've been to Scotland and Ireland as well, I assume.
Yes.
And have you had experiences of the she when you were in these places?
Yes. Well, Scotland really opened me up. And that was before I went to Ireland, actually. And so this was a trip with Freddie Silva, and he is one of the leading researchers on sacred sites and crop circles. And he's written a number of books, and he's a fantastic speaker. And so he would do these little boutique tours, and he'd only take six people. And so he was doing one to the Outer Hebrides of Scotland. And I don't even remember signing up, but somehow his email entered my inbox, and I opened it up and I saw the photos. Because he's a photographer, and I barely read the text. Every hair on my body stood on end, and I was like, I have to go. And I went to the bank that day and like actually took money out. I didn't have much dough at all, and I was like, I better take this out because this check can't bounce. And like sent that off to him that day, and then I knew this is a pilgrimage, and so I got to, make money here and make this happen. This was before I started my retreats or just before. In any case, so I met everyone in Glasgow, and then we flew to the Isle of Lewis, which is where the Great Stone Circle of Callanish is, and then there are smaller stone circles as well. And so we were in this small stone circle, or he took us there first, and I ended up in the center of the circle, and Freddie was explaining how, look, these were built on geomagnetic hotspots. The stone itself is usually often paramagnetic, meaning it carries charge. And then these are geometrically precise, mathematically precise. I mean, it's really, there's a science to this. So when you are standing at one of these stones or in the center, you're in a charge field, and we're mostly water. So water carries a charge, so you're going to be affected. And so, I mean, I didn't really have any of that information. I just was. I wanted to have this experience. And I stood in the center and I just sort of closed my eyes and just got real quiet. And then I felt at some point a tall male being on my left. And he extended his hand and there was a golden orb in his hand. Now, I'm not clairvoyant, I'm clairsentient, so you feel, and I'm claircognizant, so you know. And so I felt all of this and I could feel the frequency. And so I actually reached out and I took it and I placed it in my heart center. And as soon as I did, I felt like I had a device in there. And I had brought my digital recorder because if I get inspired or whatever, it's just a great little tool. And so after that, we went to Kalanish and I had an experience with a stone there that I just spoke to the spirit in the stone, but I was speaking in pure poetry. And so every place we went, poetry was flowing through me. And so it's also thought by, the Celts that poetry and also music as well is a gift from the fairy, from the she. And to the ancients, poetry, that was like you've been touched by the gods, and the Greeks would put honey on their baby's lips in the hopes that they would grow to be a poet or and or a philosopher. So when I got home from that, I could feel, I'm like, I think they came home with me. And then I thought, what would happen if I just opened my computer? And then it just, the first message just flowed through. And for the next 3 months, it was just pouring through. And it would come often as I was waking up in the morning. So you're in that, I think the Celts call it the thin state, the liminal realm. You're sort of almost awake, but you're still kind of asleep. Anyway, so the poetry would come through, and it got to the point where I would just go to sleep with my digital recorder. And so if I, felt the words coming in, it's like a doorway opens and this flood of poetry, just hit record and it's like taking dictation. So, these areas are very, they've got a lot of charge to them. And again, being that we are water and there's those charges carry a certain frequency, you're going to pick up on certain areas, especially if you are more sensitive and intuitive. And Ireland as well, there were some very wonderful areas where we went where it was palpable, but I was with a group and I was leading, co-leading a group with a wonderful guy, John Wilmot, who is known as the Woodland Bard, and he is an elder and a wealth of information. He's amazing. And so yeah, so we led a group of 10 people and I did three of those tours. One the first year, two the second year, and they were really special, really wonderful. But it was different because I was leading. I didn't have, but in any case, yeah. But Ireland, Scotland, my heart is in those two countries. Beautiful.
Well, I know that you've gone to these stone circles in Scotland, and you have a poem called Stone Circle Whispers. So I was wondering if you could share that with us.
Yes. All right. This was. Those stones were speaking through me. I just love this. The great stones that make circles round, strategically placed upon the ground, beneath the ground, the circuitry of Earth's magnetics you can't see. Then there is geometry within the stones, again unseen. The math creates a frequency, a vortex that will help you see. A layering of energies found too in sacred groves of trees. The stones, like trees, are quite alive, programmed by wise folk who did strive to create earthly libraries for those seeking the mysteries. And in these circles are vibrations that are felt within your nation, designed to raise your frequency and open your third eye to see. A kind of prehistoric phone, so that you'll know you're not alone, for these designs will blow the mind. The architects of these great finds gained access to colleges in the stars, from which they were given special powers. These architects knew someday the hour of ignorance would thoroughly scour the earth, whose good folk would be slaves, subject to false leaders depraved. Long past unwritten history, initiates of the mystery could see far flung of what's to come, the voices of the cycles sung. And so, preparing for the fall, great stones were placed in ways that call, inviting folk to stand within a circle round where they'd begin to understand technologies designed to open eyes to see. These great stones hold the energy that long was placed by wise ones, we, the shining ones you call the she. The knowledge here will set you free. Allow us to take up your time with this very simple rhyme. We are an electric current flowing throughout time and space. When you activate in circles, you can take us any place, for those great circles were designed to activate us in your mind. Initiate stood in circle center, calling in the ancient mentors. If you've prepared with heart, mind ready, if you stand there tall and steady, if you're humble and receptive, we can give you your directive. You can tap your ancient lifetimes. We provide a kind of lifeline here for folk at any time, a pilgrimage to realign and speak with ancestors divine. The great stones may look old and battered. We will say it doesn't matter. Set in stone we once did cast, these places hold the knowledge vast. To those who come with right intention, we'll apprise them of inventions they will work with in their minds and bring them forth at certain times. And we think you would all agree that at this time in history, the secret knowledge these stones hold must be made active by the bold who come to us from all directions, standing in these bold erections, called to visit wise ones tall and break the spell that they are small. Many of you have come before, initiates old knew what's in store, as earth now stands before the door, a perilous time that you are in, how great the ignorance and the sin, as shameless leaders create spin that tricks the masses, sucks them in. You good-hearted ones who weep for all the folk who are asleep, you are a living bridge of grace. We look with pride upon your face. Find a circle, sacred place, that when you see it makes heart race. Worry not if you can't get there. We are here to make you aware. The metaphor of circles divine concerns the power of your mind, whose faculties were overtaken by outside interests, those forsaken ones who think they run this place. Well, we are here to change the pace. Now let's get back to your great minds that hold a hidden wand divine. The time is now to learn to use this wand within that they've abused. Your thinking habits must be changed, your neural networks rearranged. It's time to call the magic back. It's time to call the knowledge back and access secrets old. This is a task that you can hack. Rise to the moment bold. In the center of your chest, there sits a cauldron hot, technology once placed in you that you have not been taught quite how to use effectively, and even, we'd say, magically, combined with mind that has been cleared, and then effectively it's steered. The correct weaving of these tools creates a kind of inner battery. In this way, you're no longer fools and prey to the false flattery of what the constructs of your day persuade you all to be. Instead, you'll find your own design that sets your good soul free. This wondrous treasure you contain turns on your DNA, and in a kind of fast forward, your ignorance you'll slay. The body vessel that you're in is really like a ship. It has for long been programmed one way. We are about to flip that program on its head and activate the codes within. But you must be on board for this in order that you win the prize of gold. The knowledge old of which you will remember is found within that great cauldron beneath which burns the embers that cast the light you hold within, running that great ship you steer. But that great light's become quite dim. Your enemy is fear. We seek to cast a spell here now through this delivered rhyme. We say to those who've waited long that you are in the time of cosmic forces opening, and shining ones with their great wings will call you from your slumbering. To clear your mind of misperceptions, we will point to the direction you must look for the inception, bringing you a point of view that you will recognize as true. The cauldron stoked by your heart's light, magician's pyre you must ignite. Feel in your heart center palpably the presence of something you cannot see, but rather feel it presently and magnify it expertly. Be aware of this cauldron throughout the day that provides the medium for the Fae to undermine the spells of deception. We offer you a vast injection, enabling you to feel the might of the beauty you hold, your true birthright. Combine the feel of cauldron and heart with the power of mind that helps you start creating in ways that summon light, casting out the dark of night. For in your mind there lies the grail, whose powers it is time to hail. Let go the stories you've outgrown that keep you chained to a false home. Whatever you have thought to date, it's time for you to clear the slate and still yourself to feel the beat stoked by that magic cauldron's heat. Create a vision in your mind. Call back to you ancestors kind who'll help you fuel that ship you're in, will give you knowledge to begin to steer yourselves to waters calm, where you'll become the healing balm that soothes the troubled among your folk. And by example, you will stoke their fire within so they can see that within them lives the mystery. This place within will set you free. It is with inner eyes you'll see. The veils are parting wide now, dears. We're in the time prophesied by seers, when communication will exceed what imagination can conceive, and you will know yourselves again. Earth's people will once more be sane, and so know this to be your truth. Seek out our wisdom like a sleuth. We're found within that cauldron bright. We're here to help you end this night.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So many people have this Celtic heritage that's been kind of lost to us because it was, you know, intentionally eradicated in many ways.
Oh, they tried to genocide the Irish.
Yeah.
When they did the land clearings there and also in Scotland.
Yeah.
It's brutal.
And so I am endlessly fascinated with this idea of this trying to reclaim that heritage and whatnot. And it seems to me that, again, kind of circle back around, that the mushroom is a way of doing that, of guiding us to that reclamation of what is our rightful heritage.
Yes. It's so interesting because it's so well ensconced in Mexico and there's a tradition there, you know, and yet it's so interesting because I had some of my training, you know, there in the Yucatan. It was wonderful. I had talk about it in the book and I had this experience at Palenque, also co-leading a group with my shaman teacher there. An experience with the Red Queen, and I'll let people read the book, but at one point, you know, she plucked a feather. She had this huge headdress on and she handed me the feather, and I had a moment of doubt and I ended up giving the feather back.
Right.
And then a few months later did a mushroom journey where the beings said, daughter, it's time to explore your own magical bloodlines. Because when I left Palenque, I knew my time here in the Yucatan is done. I'll never be back. I just knew that.
Right.
And they said, you are a Celt. And so that's all they said.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and this is what I love about how the mushroom teaches, because it'll give you little clues, little insights.
Right.
And then you come out of it and then you need to go do the digging.
Yeah, they give you homework.
Homework, yeah. But then you have the ahas, right?
So two things that you have mentioned, I wanted to ask you about. And the first one is you've talked a few times about being psychic. And you wrote in the book, this is a direct quote, my sensitivity to the subtle intelligence has developed markedly over my years of engagement with the mushroom, which has changed my brain over time to where my natural psychic abilities have been enhanced. And I wanted to ask you this question, and this isn't really part of the book, but I thought, you know, I want to ask you this. I interviewed someone who's local in Denver, who has done a lot of research and training in terms of things like remote viewing and telekinesis and whatnot. And that episode will be out probably in about 4 weeks or so. But he did this experiment because in the literature, I know Stanislav Grof writes about this and a few others do with psychedelics, that there are these reports that it enhances psychic ability. So this fellow, Sean McNamara is his name, he did a study. He got some of his friends together and he tried to have, a control group, an experimental group. And they tried first micro to see if that would enhance any of the psychic abilities. And then he alone did the macro dosing. And he tried psilocybin and I think LSD and DMT and whatnot. And his conclusion was that not really, they don't really help. And
After one journey.
Well, and that's what, well, he said that they helped a little bit, but, and he gives all the data of these people that he was experimenting with. And there really didn't seem to be any kind of increase. And I had,
Over how much time? How many times did they?
I forget, it was several months that they were doing this. But one of the things I thought, and we talked, and he would be open to these things, but one of the things I thought is like, well, maybe you're not going to get that increase in just a few months, but it is over extended periods of time and getting familiar with the medicine that you're working with. And so I wanted to bring that up to ask you, and I think I already know the answer, by what you're saying, was your perspective on that.
Well, I realized after a few years of working with the mushroom, I said, gosh, I think this exacerbates or enhances your proclivities. I think for someone who is naturally intuitive, psychic, it's going to enhance that. And also, I just look to the Druids who studied for 12 years, the seer poets who studied for, no, the Druids studied for 20 years, excuse me, the seer poets for 12 years, and their study was quite varied, but magic was a part of that. We're talking years, not months. We're so in this culture, we're just like, think, oh yeah, I'm taking this workshop and I'm gonna have this done, but I'm doing a workshop on shadow, and then what, you're gonna be done with your shadow work? No, no, no.
It's always ongoing. Always ongoing. But I'm glad that you mentioned magic because many of your poems came across as spells. And I think some of them are very specifically spells. And so I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit about working with the mushrooms and magic and the spells.
Because those first 2, 3 years, like I said, when it was all about get your mind right, dear. And one of the things they said, which I just thought was so perfect, they said, because I would worry about this and this, and they would say, it is but a spell, dear, and nothing more. And so they were teaching me, it's all spells. When we speak, we're spelling, aren't we? We're spelling words. And magic is all throughout our language. And even like the television, and media, it's like a medium, so it's like the medium, so that and also we're looking at a black mirror right here, and our cell phone when it turns black. And so I'll tell you, in that maybe first or second year, my medicine partner, who's a dear friend, I called him one night, no one was in the house, and I never ever put that cell phone to my ear, ever. I just never have, thank God. But anyway, so I always prop it up on something. And it was evening, I'd done a wee bit of mushroom, and I lit a candle and I propped up the phone. And then the beings came through, and they were, by the way, reading his mind, and which was just crazy. And then at some point they said to me about the cell phone, they said, that is a scrying machine. And so to scry is when you look at a polished surface, right? And so you're looking for images into the polished surface. And one surface that they mostly used was polished black obsidian. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh my God, this is all magic. Like every king, queen had their court magician. And this was serious stuff. If you look into the work of John Dee, who was the court astrologist for Queen Elizabeth I, and his work with John Kelly. And in any case, this was no joke. They weren't fooling around here. They were working with very real forces. So anyway, so So that blew my mind because I realized, oh my God, magic is everywhere. And they were essentially saying, yeah, you're in a field of magic. And also, the wand is in here. I love that line from one of the transmissions: "For the great wand of antiquity is buried where you cannot see, for you've been told to look outside and not within where it resides." So they were helping me kind of clean this mess up here. And once I got the mess,
Right.
under control, then they started teaching me how to use my mind. And spells are often written poetically. And poetry itself casts a spell. I think it's just in us that we know if you're going to listen to a poem or if you're going to write a poem, something subtly shifts. It's like something deeper in us knows that, oh, this is, we're leaving kind of the common parlance, the mundane sort of way we speak, and this is very different. And the deep psyche recognizes it. And certainly, again, because poetry was spoken, poetic language was much more poetic in every culture, really, going way back. So there's, I think, just a natural knowing. And so with the magic, they were saying, your thought, you create with this mind of yours. And all this worry, dear, you're going to create more of the same. And they said, when you are worrying, when you're in fear, you're everything's energy. You're running interference with what is trying to come forth because I'm like queen of this ship. You're king of that ship. And so every cell of this ship vessel is paying attention to the charge that I create with my thoughts because we're electrical beings. And so it was these mushroom teachers who explained to me that we are electric beings. Spirit is electric. And we're in this body vessel, and it's mostly water. Water carries a charge. And then also, because I channel these beings through, I have to drink a lot of water when I am in a mushroom journey because I have another charge field in me, sometimes more than one. And it takes a lot out of you. And also, I have to be careful because you can fry your circuits. Like, I just so much has been explained, that I understand on a deeper level about this. And also, and I'm not into the kind of magic where, I'm not summoning demons. I'm not doing any of that stuff. That's for someone else. And that can be very dangerous. You need to know what you're doing. And so it has been more organic, where I'm just learning from these spirits and then they initiate me. And so, and I'm glad we're talking about this because I wanted to say, I live my life and have lived my life since I started working with a mushroom with the sort of knowing of myself as an initiate. Like I'll be an apprentice to these teachers for the rest of my life. So I'm an initiate and I always have that sense of presence around me, and I don't, this poetry doesn't come in every day. It's not like, oh yeah, I put that on Instagram. I mean, I'm putting stuff on Instagram now because I'm putting excerpts from the book, but that's over 12 years. But in any case, but when it comes, it's a wonderful thing. They're like guides, guardians, teachers, watchers, and they are showing me what is possible when you clean up the mind and learn how to work with the mind. And I know that those kind of in charge of this planet, if you will, there's a number of them. And there's information that is kept from us. I look at it as like there's whatever, even if it's news, there's a story for the muggles, and then there's what's really going on. But in any case, they are holding on to information that could be used to uplift us. And instead, we're being schnookered every step of the way. And government literally means to control the mind. So when you can control someone's mind, you've got them. You've got them, which is why propaganda and mind control, and it's ancient, it's not new, and so this is, well, this is called a temple. And so, they're saying if you want to, this is the ultimate wand. It's in here, the genie's lamp. This is a genie's lamp. And when you don't know how to use it, you can kind of make a mess. But it's, and it wasn't until just a couple of years ago, one of my retreat clients said to me, "You sound like Frances Scovel Shen." And I said, "Who's that?" And she was a metaphysician in the 20s, 30s. And she had a very profound understanding of the Bible, you know. And I, you know what, I grew up Catholic and I had a lot of charge around all that stuff. I don't anymore because I've studied law now on my own, natural law, and you know, a lot of that comes out of the Bible. So I have a very different understanding of it. But she's also looking at it as a magical text. And so the different things that she would say was all about understanding the power of the mind. And also, you know, she would call it God. We could call it whatever, but I think we're in alchemy, you know, it's the one thing, you know, and so that is just infinite possibility. So when you can align this with that and you work together with that, we can accomplish so much. But look at what's coming at us all day, every day, just this garbage media, you know, schooling, which it just there's a, just it's a lot of garbage right now. You know, so people are not at their best and they're really being cheated, you know.
That speaks to, I always refer to it as, and I stole this phrase from the author Nabokov, but it speaks to my Gnostic turpitude, because you know, with the Gnostics, you had the archons and the demiurges, and
Yes.
the archons were the rulers, and they were keeping us all suppressed, you know. And I found personally, and it is that we, you know, it's also the monkey mind, you know, to use the Buddhist phrase, that keeps us from often realizing our own power.
Yes. Yes.
And you know, I know that, I forget the author's name that you mentioned, but Neville Goddard, I think,
Oh,
did
yes.
much the
He came
same thing.
after.
Where it's like, you know, he read the Bible in this way, as you know, whenever you read God, refer to that as yourself, that you have that creative power. And we do, we're just not using it in really good ways. Instead, it's just this destruction of the natural world. And that's, you know, my main thing is we have to get back to nature. We have to get back to being in alignment with all of it. But it starts with ourselves, you
Yes,
know?
it does.
It starts with ourselves. I wanted to ask you, since we've been talking about magic and spells and whatnot, I think one of the symbols that is often associated with this is that of the cauldron. And the
Yes.
cauldron is in the title of your book, Whispers from the Cauldron.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you if you could discuss, what is the cauldron? What is the symbolic importance of the cauldron and its relation to inspiration?
To inspiration? Okay. Well, all right. So there is a brew in a cauldron, and there is probably the most well-known of the Celtic mythology is the Welsh story of the goddess Ceridwen and her cauldron's brew, which was for her son Alfagdu, also known as Morfrenn, and he was quite unfortunate, and I think he was really not attractive at all, and so and just kind of dull, and so this brew would gift him poetic eloquence, and he would have knowledge of the all, and so this brew was to steep for a year and a day, and so she had a blind man tend the fire and a young boy, Guyenbach, who was in charge of this brew. And 3 drops of the brew would confer this gift of poetic brilliance. And if you had more of that, you would die. So that cauldron, this is telling you there's some kind of probably psychoactive brew going on here. And the dose has to be just right. And it's got to, you know, sit for, you know, there's rules around this. And so what that cauldron is holding is the possibility of complete transformation and also, you know, that magic rebirth, death, rebirth, transmutation. I mean, it's a powerful, powerful symbol. And it sits on 3 legs. And so there was kind of the mundane use of the cauldron, which was absolutely essential to the ancient Celts. And so, you know, you brewed your food in there, you transport liquids, you could even bathe in there if it was big enough. And so there was that, but then there was this magical quality to it. And then, of course, what happens to young Guyenbach is I think the brew splashed and he got some on his thumb. And so he put his thumb in his mouth to quell the pain. And three drops were on his thumb. And he was instantly transformed. And Carrie Dwen got wind of that. And she flew into a rage and chased him, and they both shapeshifted into different animals and birds. And then finally he shapeshifted into a seed, and she became a black hen, and peck and peck and peck, and then she got him and she ate him. And then he gestated inside her for 9 months, and then she birthed him as the famous poet Taliesin. And so, it's just the symbol of transformation. Now, to the seer poets of old Ireland, the cauldron was sort of akin to the womb of the goddess Brigid or Breed. And she was the goddess, she's the goddess of smithcraft and healing and fire, water, and poetry. And so they saw the cauldron as her womb, and they would go, their training took place at Samhain. So that's around Halloween after the harvest and everything. So the days are shorter, the nights are longer. And so just before daylight, they would go into, they were called houses of darkness. They were these windowless small houses, and they would have their lessons from their teacher, and they'd lie down and they'd wrap their plaids around their heads, and they'd have a stone on their belly, and they would stew essentially within that cauldron. And they would, come up through emotion. And by the way, the old ancient Celts, they weren't afraid of sorrow and grief and yearning. That fed those emotions fed the poetry, so that you could come up with something deeply stirring and beautiful. So they would spend all day in this house of darkness, then they would come out at darkness and then recite for their teacher. And then they would do this every day until the call of the first cuckoo in early spring in March. And they would be bereft when they heard the sound of that cuckoo. Like, this was just, so dear to their hearts, this experience. And it was a real brotherhood. It was mostly men. There were women involved as well. But just like how it's interesting, because shamanic women have been dismissed over time. And that's what Barbara Tedlock, in her book, The Woman in the Shaman's Body, talks a lot about that. It's really interesting. Same with the women poets. And so, but there were female poets, absolutely, back in the day. But in any case, I think their training is really something. And so, and then they would essentially give birth to the poem. But that house of darkness was the cauldron for them. And also, there were three cauldrons, and there is a poem called The Three Cauldrons of Poesy, and it talks about these specific cauldrons. And so the first cauldron is the cauldron of incubation, and it's basically the pelvis. It's said to be like the dantian, which is three finger widths below the belly. And so that cauldron represented for the poet, that was those initial years of training. They're learning the foundations, the basics, and really kind of setting that within them. And then in the heart center was the cauldron of motion, as in emotion. And so that's where, this is further into their training, where they're really learning to take these deep emotions, to feel very deeply, and through that compose something absolutely just beautiful, beautiful words. And the last, I think, 4 years or so of their training was high magical training. So divination was huge. Blessings, curses. I'll talk about the three different types of poetry there. And also something, it's very similar to psychometry. So it was thought that the whorls of the fingers, you could touch something with that, and you'd get a download of information on that. Now, these poets also carried staffs, and you could do it with the tip of your staff. And so two poets could kind of meet each other on the road and just touch staffs, and they would get a full download of information on each other, everything they need to know. So that was, they were teaching them that. But there was all these years of study, a good 8 years before. I mean, I'm sure that was peppered in there. But then these last 4 years were very much about that, so that the cauldron of wisdom was up here. And so that would, you would come out of that training as all-knowing as like a Taliesin or an Amargin, the famous poets. And there were three kinds of poetry, which is interesting. There was black, white, and speckled. And so these poets, they were of such high rank that they were above the law, and they were on par with the king. So they would write this amazing poetry for, celebrating the, with praise of the king. And so that was white poetry. Black poetry was satire. And so you could absolutely take a king or someone of very high rank, just take them out with those words, right? Because after that, and of course, they're so cleverly composed that no one could ever look at that person with a straight face again, because all they keep thinking, so it's just like, just destroy any kind of, rank that they had. Speckle poetry was a warning. So if someone was skating on thin ice with a very influential poet, well then they're gonna give you a warning. You better get that together. Now, what did happen, I think this is very interesting, is you did have poets, and once they graduated, by the way, they were called olim, which means doctor of poetry, or it's pronounced olav. And so, and that wasn't just for poets, it was also for people in law as well. Olim means you have, you have, you're at the pinnacle of your art, you have reached the pinnacle. But there were some who abused their position, and they would show up to these kings' homes, estates, with an entourage, and the king would have to feed them all and put them up for days, weeks, months sometimes. Like, they could bankrupt a king, and the threat would be, oh, I will satirize you. And so you have those guys in every profession, people who will just take full advantage. But that was the level of power they had. And also, they could say, come up with a poem that would, cast a spell, like a curse, and make someone very sick or worse. So a lot of power. And back to what we're talking about before, earlier, with magic, it's the power of the word. And you know what? Doctors do it every day. You have 3 months to live. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But when people give their power to that person in a white coat that we've been conditioned to give our power to, they obediently will die to the day. And so words are really powerful.
They are, definitely are. So speaking of words, maybe this is a good time to ask you to read one of the poems. And you've got a couple on the cauldron. I know one is just titled The Cauldron, but I thought since that's what we've been talking about, perhaps you could read a cauldron poem for us.
I shall. All right. Okay. I will preface this by saying, when I told you the story of what happened in Scotland, when I put that orb in my heart center, later on that trip at a different site that we're at, it came in to me where they said, think of that as a cauldron. Work with that cauldron. So then that brought in this poetry, and there are a couple of other poems in here about a cauldron. So this is what they said. Dear, we won't let you forget. Rest assured that we will whet your appetite to know far more. You've only just opened the door to everything that's come before. It will come through revelations, stirring life within your nation. Stay the course with your good ship. Soon the wisdom from your lips will bear the mark of one who knows. The cauldron's fire in you grows. Stoke it well and use the breath. Energize that center with the visionary thoughts in mind. We are offering you kind advice to help you to awake, for at this time, so much at stake. So I'm just going to say, It gives me chills to read this now after doing the research I've done on these seer poets and their training, because that would be the cauldron of motion in here. Emotions being stirred, and also, that power of the word, and that piece at the end of saying at this time so much is at stake. Like, we have a mess on our hands, and people need inspiration because they're demoralized. And that is part of the propaganda campaign, is demoralization. And oh my God, I mean, you just see it in so many people. And if they're demoralized, they're not going to fight. Sorry, my cat's scratching. This is on the cat scratcher. Okay, sweetie. Anyway, so yeah, the power of the word is really important. I do think. I sense that the initiates of old and, the poets, the seers, that they're being called now to just stand in their gifts. And because, of course, people are inspired by poetry, by good music, by the artist. The artist can lift people up in profound ways.
What was the quote you gave by Terence McKenna about the artist?
He said that the artists were the shamans.
I often think about there's a wonderful documentary. You can watch it on YouTube. I think it's called The Heart of the World, and it's a BBC documentary where they go somewhere in the Amazon, and it's a tribe that really had no contact with the outside world.
Think I know what you're
The
talking about.
Kogis, I think was the name of the
Yes,
tribe.
and they stay in darkness, right?
But they had a message. They referred to themselves as the elder brothers, and the folks in the Western world, were the younger brothers. And their message from it, and it's a shamanic message, is, essentially, you are destroying our mother. You need to get back into alignment with the mother, with the earth. And so let me ask you this. I know we're running out of time, and but I do want to ask you, with the messages that you get, is there a similar kind of message for that you are receiving to give to the world in terms of our sort of global healing?
Global healing. Okay. I will say, first of all, these messages, they don't mince words. They're immensely kind, but they're speaking, very succinctly. One, I'm trying to remember which message it came from, but the end of it said, it will take catastrophe for the sleeping ones to see. Know that if it comes, that we, the shining ones you call the she, will walk with you eternally. Something to that effect. And you will walk this earth again with the shining ones. I forget exactly the end of it, but I never forgot that. It will take catastrophe for the shining ones to see. Now, listen, everything is kind of a metaphor for everything else. And I had my experience at 40 that I call my midlife face slap. And that put a lot to a halt. And it was crisis, and crisis is initiation. And we got so many crises going on, too many to count. And the caca is, I don't think it's even hit the fan fully yet. I also think I had a conversation with this geomancer, dowser, Alana Moore. She's written a number of books. We were talking about this morning. And how this age we're in, Aquarius, it's an air sign, and it rules this technology, electricity, all of that. And how we've got this Wi-Fi, all this electromagnetic radiation, these 5G cell towers, all of this insanity, insanity. We're bathing in it every day. Migrating birds are being affected, honeybees, but also all kinds of insects are just disappearing because they're extra sensitive and they've got these antenna, they need this the earth frequencies, and it's affecting us on a cellular level. I think we barely dipped a toe in Aquarius, and I think these next, 20 years or so, we're going to get a very hard and important and essential lesson in working with frequencies, because there's a way to work with them and there's a way not to work with them. And a lot of this stuff is military, so you've got boys with toys, that really they're playing with the toys of the gods, with no wisdom, just power, 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 all over the world, and competition and all this stuff that's going on. And so that's coming. But I don't mean that as now. I also know there's a lot coming. There's also opportunity. There is an opportunity because these beings, by the way, we're made to think, oh, man is such a cancer on the mankind. I see it more like this is cyclical, just like nature, because we're nature. There are times on this planet when we are connected and we're, cohesive and we are stewarding well. And then there are other times like now. I mean, we're in a dip. Come on. I mean, that's obvious. We've forgotten, right? We've lost our tradition. Actually, I had a mushroom journey where I was speaking with the fairy queen and I asked her about all of this. And she said very succinctly, the consequence when one forgets. It's that simple. We've forgotten. And we've also forgotten that there is this higher, grander power that we should be listening to, because nature has laws and those laws are timeless, they're forever. And so we ignore her laws and her cycles at our peril. And lo and behold, we're imperiled. So there will be, it's cause and effect. That's one of the seven laws in alchemy, the Kybalion. So at the same time, I don't know. I don't have fear. My heart cries at times because I can see what we're capable of in a beautiful way. I think what we are meant to do, though, is to access our gifts. This is what people need. This is what this planet needs. And whatever that gift is, if whatever it is, live that gift, because someone's trying to shut us all down. And so I always say, because I'm an Aries, I'm a fiery warrior, I'm not going down on my knees. And at the same time, putting this book out, so I'm in my ninth year of retreats, they're really, I'm moving out of that. I can feel, I mean, I still do here and there, but I'm being called out of my safe cocoon to go out there further with this book, with my teaching. And I've had 12 years apprenticeship. It's like kind of graduation. And I'm not comfortable with that at all. I'm really not. I prefer, to be like this, but I'm also not independently wealthy. I'm not like I can just do whatever. It's like, no, I have to work. And I love to teach and share and inspire. Just prefer smaller groups. But anyway, it's like, so. But that's the call. Whatever the call, it's my call. But whatever the call is, it's not like, oh, I'm going to go out there and save the world. It's just, no, I'm going to share with those with ears to hear and eyes to see. And everyone's kind of got their thing. And in that way, we make this world a more beautiful place and maybe leave it a little bit better than, when we showed up. That's how I look at this. And also another line from one of the transmissions said, one by one becomes most all. So even if you feel like you're the only one or you're alone and no one's, this is a big world. There are a lot of people waking up, a lot of people waking up. And also Uranus is at play. And the planet Uranus is, it is electric. It's lightning fast change, change on a dime. And it's one of the rulers of Aquarius. And Uranus says, which is my favorite line of all, you're not the boss of me. When it says, oh, this is how you think it's going to go? Really? Watch this. Boom, changes like that. So, this is a wild time to be here. Anything can happen.
No, I agree. And what you said, you hit several themes that keep coming up with the guests that I speak to. For example, the that we've forgotten. Many of the guests say, we need to remember who we are. And I always put that into the context of a shamanic initiation, because a lot of people also say, yes, we are in an initiation. We are in a crisis. As you noted earlier, initiation is a crisis. And part of the shamanic initiation often is a symbolic dismemberment. And then the shaman has to remember themselves. And so that, and I think that idea of living authentically, you know, that's those are our challenges to remember who we are and to live from that core space of who, you know, who we truly are, our integrity and our authenticity.
Yes.
Yeah. So I agree. So thank you for the message.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. This has just been great, Nick. My goodness. Love talking to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed this quite a bit as well. So let me ask you two final questions. What do you have coming up? What are you going to be working on? I know you've suggested that you're going to be moving out of offering the retreats. What's coming up in your
Well,
future?
I'm actually going to be teaching a course live, and I haven't done that in a few years. And it's called the Three Cauldrons of Poetry, and it goes for 12 weeks. And so the first class, I will talk all about these poets and their training, but then we're going to get into each of the three cauldrons, how to work with that, how to activate that, because these are forces within the body that they understood. And there's different traditions around this. This is the tradition from the seer poets. And then their magical training as well. And obviously, none of that stuff was written down. We don't have all, but we have a good idea of it. And so I'm bringing something to the table here in terms of my own research and experimentation with this. And so the course is ultimately to inspire people to call up the magic that they're holding that they may not even realize that they're carrying, or those especially who are in the arts, like I had an artist just sign up for the course yesterday, to just even bring more to her art. And so that begins April 22nd, and so that's for 12 months. And then I'm just going to be promoting this book. And then I do sessions with people, which I love, just, online sessions. And then we'll see, maybe I'll do some speaking or,
All
I'll
right.
do more teaching, but the teaching will continue. There's a
All right.
lot I want to share.
Okay, wonderful. And where can people go to find out more about you and your work and get the information about the class?
Yeah, my website is my name, shonahome.com with two H's, Shona and then home.com,
Okay.
and everything's on there.
All right.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And where's your book, the most recent one, Poetic Whispers from the Cauldron of the Other World?
Yeah,
Where
the
can
world,
people?
the publisher is logosophiabooks.com. I absolutely
Okay.
love the name, Logosophia.
Yeah.
It'll be available on Amazon and the usual suspects, but if people
Okay.
go to the publisher, that's just always better. You
Okay.
know, they're a
Right.
small publisher, which I love.
Okay.
And yeah.
Yeah, I'll put a link for that in the show notes in the video description, as well as your webpage so that people can more easily access it. So, well, Shona, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I feel like I could talk to you a lot longer, but I know we both have days to get to here. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Nick.
And that's a wrap on episode 134 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media, subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing, all of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I do now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.